You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, September 3rd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, folks, it's a special two-for-one. First up, Harold Pollack, professor of Social Services Administration at the University of Chicago, on, yes, Social Security Disability Insurance. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. This is my... Is it my Nirvana or Valhalla? Matt, why are you just staring at the board when I ask you that question? You don't know, you know what I'm referring to on either one of those accords, do you? No, I think when I told people the other day that I was going to have someone on to talk Social Security Disability Insurance, people noticed a pronounced, a spark in my voice?
Extra kick in your step.
An extra kick in my step. I mean, I'm sitting, but
it's like a kick in my... It's like you're floating on air. Though.
Right. Kick in my vocal step, if you will. Also on the program today, because I couldn't let summer slip away without talking to David Dayan again. And we did a special omnibus, if you will, interview with David Dayan. Sometimes I just go over to his site and just say, like, I'd like to talk to him about this, but I also like to talk to him about that. And I'd like to talk to him about that. You know what? It's my show. I'll do that. I'll do all three. So two great interviews for you today. I don't know if we're going to have a show tomorrow. I'm not even recording this today.
Ooh.
I'm recording it 2 days before I say this now.
The suspense.
Yeah, I don't know. It's possible. We may or may not. And on Monday, at the very least, we will have our special Labor Day show where we take some speeches, some Labor Day speeches, and put them in. I don't know which ones we're going to do. I'm trying to curate that. Apparently, some of the good labor speeches, they didn't have YouTube at the time. And so it becomes a little more...
Good
tricky.
Job, labor movement.
Yes, exactly. Maybe if folks in the labor movement had access to a time machine, we wouldn't have these problems. So next time, if you are contemplating getting a time machine, you should get one. That's all I'm saying. Folks, you know where a time machine would come in handy? I will tell you. Starting in just days with the start of the NFL season. Now, I, of course, am very excited for the Pats to play the Steelers on Monday night. Is it Monday night? Yeah. Tuesday night. Monday or Tuesday night. I can't remember. It doesn't matter. Because with the football season, so starts the fantasy football season. And let's talk fantasy football for a minute. FanDuel Week 1 games are almost here. FanDuel is the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. So in other words, you don't have to get involved in like a, I don't know, three-month, four-month commitment. They're paying out over $75 million a week this football season. They have a salary cap format where you can pick any players you want for just 1 week. You're not tied in to, like, you know, with your salary cap, you can't have, I don't know, this linebacker who's making too much, and also get that that quarterback. Entry fees start at just $1. Anyone can play. So go to FanDuel.com. Click on the microphone up in the right upper right-hand corner. It's very obvious up there. Use my code MAJOR, as in Majority Report, right? Did you not know where that came from, Matt?
I was like, I wonder where they gave, why would they give us that?
Are you serious?
Well, yeah, why? Why don't you give us a rapport?
Are you joking?
Yes, I'm joking.
Okay, I just wanted to double check on that. It's MAJOR. Sign up now. It's a special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it with up to $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. Offer's only good for the first 50 people that use the code MAJOR today, or, you know, later today, tomorrow. You got to get there is the point. Don't forget to use the code MAJOR. FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. That's FanDuel, F-A-N-Duel, D-U-E-L.com. I'm going to assume you know how to spell com. Sign up today.
C-O-M.
Right. So, first up, we will be talking to Harold Pollack. But before we do, I should also tell you about, now, where the heck is this? Oh, okay. So this is awesome. I've told people this many times. On Monday of this week, Saul and Myla and Nikki came home from Michigan. Now, aside from other stuff that happened in Michigan, Nikki went back to see her parents, and I had stuff to do here. I was avoiding the in-laws. The good news is Nikki came back from Michigan and said, hey, we're not moving to Michigan. Not that I was ever invested in that. But the important thing is this. I had to do MSNBC that night. They didn't get home until I got home. Literally the first thing that Saul did, came over, hugged me, rubbed his hand in my face and said, smooth. I swear to God. And no. I swear to God.
No.
I swear to God. He's very obsessed with the shaving now, and I've actually shown him how to shave. But I've told him you cannot mess with the razor when daddy's not around because it's obviously it's dangerous and you don't know what he's going to do. Well, and the razor I showed him with is not the crap that I used to do. It's actually a nice sort of like stainless steel looking razor from Harry's. I've talked about Harry's before, but it's fantastic. Now, I'm not a fan of shaving. Everybody knows that. And there was nothing I hated more than the idea of, like, got to go to the clerk at Dwayne Reed. Can you open up the big case so I can get the razor? All that. No. I'm not going to pay $32 for a pack of 8 blades. At Harry's, it's about half the price. They make their blades in Germany. They ship them directly to you. The starter set is an amazing deal. For $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 razor blades. Use the promo code MAJORITYREPORT. You get $5 off that amazing deal. That's if it's your first time buying this. So go to harrys.com now, and Harry will give you $5 off if you type in my coupon code MAJORITYREPORT with your first purchase. That harrys.com. And enter the coupon code MAJORITYREPORT at checkout for $5 off and start shaving better today.
London calling, see we ain't got no swing. except for the rain, the crunch of thing. The ice is coming, the sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected, the wheat is going thin. Engine stop on it.
We are back on the Majority Report. I'm Sam Cedar on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Harold Pollack. He is a professor of social service administration at the University of Chicago, and he is writing in The Atlantic on how to save SSDI, or Social Security Disability Insurance. Welcome to the program, Harold.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, the Social Security Disability Insurance, over the course of the past couple of years, has become, it seems to me, one of those things that something that's going to become, I think, increasingly so, a major political football, because there's a big part of it which confirms, I think, sort of macro narratives of conservatives in this country, that there is, that this is a program that is rampant with fraud, that it is growing exponentially, and it is a waste. Before we get into the, well, we'll get to that, but tell us what the status of or Social Security Disability Insurance is. Or in fact, before we even get there, what is it for people who don't know?
So if so, there are two major federal disability programs. There's SSI, which is really if you're, say, disabled from early childhood and have low income, or if you haven't really been attached to the workforce, you might receive SSI benefits. And then there's SSDI, which is really, you know, which is Social Security Disability Insurance. So if you work for a number of quarters and then you suffer a back injury and you can't work anymore, you would receive a Medicare card and a monthly benefit, which depends on, you know, the number of years that you were working and how much you were earning and so on. And that's something that we all have if we're working, certainly in the private sector. SSDI is a large program. There are about 8.9 million people who are receiving benefits from it, and it is, as you pointed out, it is a flashpoint of dispute between Democrats and Republicans, particularly since there is a need for some adjustments to be made to make sure that the trust fund that finances it is, you know, doesn't run out of money.
And so this is a program which is financed through our payroll taxes, along with Medicare and I guess Social Security insurance as a basically an old age as a retirement insurance.
That's right. That's right. It's one of the components that we all have and that most of us don't even have to think about. It's just something that's there in case we ever suffer a serious health problem and we need to rely on that benefit.
And I guess I should include in that insurance orphan, loss of parent insurance, I guess, as well. So let's so give us a sense of why it would be that SSDI would be running out of money. I mean, how is it paid out in a way, in a manner that is different? How is it that our Social Security, the old age insurance is scheduled to last now, I think, according to last Social Security trustees report, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, apologies, mm-hmm. but I think it's like around 2036, 35 now. I'm not 100% sure on that. But presumably it is further than a year from basically December.
That's right. We have sometime around 2034 is when the old age component of Social Security, you know, is slated to you know, to deplete that trust fund. But the SSDI trust fund, which is also funded through our payroll taxes, but there's a mathematical algorithm that allocates the money, that is scheduled to run out around Election Day next year. Now, this has happened many times before in one flavor or another, and in the past, what's happened is that you know, there's some money is moved around across the trust funds, and the sort of mechanical changes are made. It's going to politically, that's that, you know, that's going to be much harder this year. It's become a much more difficult political issue than it's been in the past.
Has there been any attempts in the past to sort of rejigger that algorithm? I mean, so that it is more sustainable or more in line with projections as to when, and we should say in 2034, if nothing is done, and these are just the projections, which actually change from year to year, depending on how much is coming into the system. But Social Security will be able to pay out somewhere between 80% and 85%, or I should say 75% and 85% of promised benefits.
But, that's right.
But has there been any attempt to sort of make a long-term structural fix on this? Or has been the attitude of like, well, who's going to deny disabled people, people who are unwilling to work, who's going to deny them their payments? So this is something that we can fix on an ad hoc basis as it comes up.
Well, I think that the ad hoc basis has been the compromise that in general has been the thing that our political system can do. There are a number of structural fixes proposed. The problem is that that we really can't agree on the fixes. And one of the challenges that is there is, if we made this program, more punitive, if we made the eligibility requirements more stringent, if we reduced the benefits, we would definitely improve the program's financial stability. But you're dealing with some of the most vulnerable people in the society who have significant health problems and who are either totally unable to work or able to work only, with low wages and low numbers of hours per year. So if we messed with the program to make it less generous, the human consequences could be very great. So there's been a healthy conservatism, not in the ideological sense, but conservatism in the sense of let's not go and mess with this and harm people while we're trying to make it come into balance. Now, on the other side, what we probably need to do is to permanently increase the revenue that goes into this program. And I think ultimately that's the most humane and most politically sustainable thing to do, but it's we're not exactly living in a moment in American society where tax increases to expand a social insurance program or to acknowledge the expansion of a program that's already on the ground expanded, we're not in a moment where that is a really easy or popular thing to do.
And it also strikes me, that is why the notion that there's rampant fraud, why that notion has such has such strong currency in conservative circles because, look, there's an easy way to get this into balance. We just cut the program we just say, okay, we're not going to be the kind of society that says if you're too sick to work, that we're going to do anything to help you in that situation. So if you're either faced with that notion or you're faced with the idea of like, we should really make this work long term, or you come up with the idea that there's this rampant fraud that's going on. So give us just a brief history of sort of the growth of this program and what your digging into this has found was driving the growth at different times. And then we'll get to the current day to find out if the growth has been as extreme as we've been told.
So there's several things going on. One is that when we have an aging population, and there are more people come onto the disability programs as they near retirement. There are just more people with serious health problems who are 58 than who are 28, and so the aging of the population is a factor. Another factor that's important is that there are more women who are in the workforce long enough to qualify for SSDI. In 1950 or 1960 or 1970, there were fewer women who had been in the workforce long enough to really qualify for a high level of benefits within this program.
So they just basically they just haven't vested in some respect.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There are just more women who are working the number of quarters required to be in the game for SSDI. There's also people on the program they have this annoying habit of not dying as much as they used to. So there's sort of increased survival of people within the program is an issue. There's also an issue that the bottom has fallen out of the blue-collar economy, and there is a relationship between economic conditions and applications for disability. That is pronounced. You see that, you know, during recessions, essentially blue-collar workers are stuck in a game of musical chairs, and during a deep recession, there are fewer chairs to sit down on, and the workers who get edged out are often the people who have some kind of disability that makes it hard for them to be competitive in a tougher labor market, and so either they have to turn to this program, or you have people who have functional impairments that would qualify for them for this program, but if the labor market were better, they would be able to find a way to get a job that allows them to continue working despite the impairment that they have.
Okay, so in other words, like Brian has a problem with his leg. He can't stand up while he's working on machinery. But in a good economy, the factory is like, look, we need everybody we can get in here. We will make accommodations for your bad leg. We'll put a special chair there because it's worth it for us to have two hands that have some set of skills. In a bad economy, they say, we've got four other Brians and they can all stand. We don't need to build that chair for you. And that's just a hypothetical that would reflect that dynamic.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And the flip side of that dynamic, that in principle, there might be another job that Brian might be able to do when the wages really drop, he looks up and says, well, in principle, maybe I could do this other job, but the wage is so low and the conditions are so problematic that maybe I should think about disability, even though I might not have thought about it, before. And he's not making it up about his leg in any of these scenarios. His leg, you can show the x-ray, it's there. He's got a heart problem, whatever it is, but the economy interacts with the opportunities that Brian confronts in a way that might bring him into contact with the disability system.
Okay, so with all those factors that are that explain part of the story of SSDI and why we have more people who are on the rolls. The fact is that you found that eligibility has not changed. It's just there's more people who are eligible because of those factors.
Yeah, I should say, by the way, that a very large number of people who apply for the program are rejected. And, one reason why we know that fraud isn't a huge problem is there's a hell of a lot of people who are rejected. And if you look at the people who are rejected and you look at how many hours they're able to work and how much money they're willing to earn when they haven't been allowed to be on disability, these are people that are earning very little over the years, when they don't have that disability option. So we know there are not a large number of really healthy workers who are jumping onto disability who would otherwise be economically independent and prosperous, without the the average benefit is about $1,150 per month in SSDI.
And so that's your average is $1,150 per month, plus you get put on Medicare presumably early, right? Because you're you're pre 65 years old.
Yes.
Right. Well, so give us a notion of like what those numbers are in terms of rejections, because I was really surprised. It was like something over half of people are rejected the first time.
Yes, absolutely. And it's a very difficult process. One of the unfortunate aspects of the public debate, which I think I could have actually presented better in my otherwise fantastic article, is that. There's two types of errors that the program is making. One is if you accept someone who is not truly disabled, and that's the one that politically people get very upset about. The other one is we fail to help someone who genuinely is disabled and who really needs the help. And so it's a long process. It often takes years. During that time, and by the way, once you get on there, there's also an additional waiting period to get Medicare insurance, which is, in fact, when I was on the working on health reform, one of the more poignant things was meeting people who were going medically bankrupt, who were actually already on SSDI, but they were still in the waiting period for Medicare.
Wow.
and they were having very punishing medical bills. I met someone's family who he had a very serious liver disease, and he was just running out of money while he was waiting for his Medicare benefit to kick in. So it is, there's some very serious problems for people that need these programs that that the current process often doesn't deal with in a very humane fashion.
So let's talk about this these rejection rates. You you actually write that the administrative judges, and I'm forgive me, I cannot the ALJs, administrative law judges.
Yes.
They are they seem to be rejecting at a higher rate. Now, there's a couple of different explanations for this, and we'll go into that in a minute. But what role do the administrative law judges play? Are they part of the Social Security Administration? Are they independent, just simply part of the judiciary? You go to family court.
They are part of the Social Security Administration's administrative process. And so they're part of this sort of extended bureaucracy of the Social Security Administration.
And
there's about 500,000 of these proceedings, I should say, every year. So it's a really – one of the challenges we have in this whole area is that, you know, disability in human life is a very multidimensional and continuous thing. And the way that it works in this program is you have to give a kind of thumbs up or thumbs down measure for this thing that is inherently much more complicated. And plus, there's 500,000 of these proceedings all around the country, and you kind of can't stop and run an OJ trial every time any individual person shows up, you know, wherever they are in the country. So it's a tremendous challenge to achieve some kind of fairness and uniformity within this sprawling system dealing with such a varied population.
Now, so there's 500 cases every year. So presumably everybody who applies, right, it basically goes in front of or has their case file adjudicated by one of these administrative law judges. So like how many of these judges exist? Like how much time are they doing something like 12,000 cases a day? I mean, I don't understand.
It's a very arduous process. I don't know the exact number of ALJs at my fingertips, but they are busy, and it is. And you know, some of the cases are very cut and dry, and if you show up and you have lung cancer, there's a bunch of unambiguous things that the system handles very well, and actually those have been very stable over time. The ones that have really attracted a lot of controversy and that are more subtle with the system are people who come in with either mood disorders or who come in with various kinds of musculoskeletal problems, back problems, neck problems, things like that, where it's genuinely hard to tell without, you know, more of an investigation. Well, what's really going on here and how debilitating is it? And, how do we think about the person's individual circumstances? The bureaucracy faces quite a huge challenge there.
And according to your piece, the ALJs have become more appeared to perhaps be more aggressive in rejecting applications than they have in the past. But there's a couple of things that could be attributable to, not to mention like an increase in applications from people who might be on the bubble.
There is one possibility is that recession has brought more people on the bubble, and I'm sure that's some of it. But one of the really striking things, so I should say that there's been a really big change during the Obama years in just the proportion of cases that are approved, and it's gone down by like 10 out of every 100 cases that apply in terms of the number that are accepted within this process. So the process is definitely more stringent than it was in 2009. And the thing that's really striking is the ALJ, if you look at the ALJs who have been doing it a long time and you compare them with the ones that have come on more recently, the ones who've come on more recently are much more stringent than the ones that have been there a long time. So there seems to be, the whole system seems to be getting more skeptical of claims, but also the new guys who come in, seem to be they're being socialized to a tougher standard than the ones that have been than the veteran guys that are working alongside them. And so something is really
what accounts
I think
for
that? Something is really changing.
Is it because they're watching, you know, 60 Minutes go on about how, you know, there's fraud here or what is it?
I think there's some of that. I think that there's a concern within you know, this big organization, this big bureaucracy, that, you know, are we being too lax on certain things, and is there a political cost to that?
Mm-hmm.
There are five states where more than 10% of the working age population are on federal disability programs, and when it reaches that point, I think that it starts to really threaten the public legitimacy of these programs. And I do think that I think there's been some sort of an implicit tightening that is occurring. I can't tell you exactly where it's coming from, but where, you know, somewhere within this ecosystem, people are saying, you know, we really have to make sure that we tighten up so that we don't, you know, we don't like to see those 60 Minutes reports and congressional hearings, that, you know, we don't want to be a political hot potato.
Right.
And so you see with the mood disorders that there's really been, you know, conspicuously fewer cases that are being approved. Now, the sad thing is that, you know, some of these cases may have been on the bubble and they deserved greater skepticism. And some of these cases, you may have been on the bubble and they're definitely people who needed the help.
Right.
And I'm sure there are errors of omission where people are being rejected from the program who really need that kind of help right now. You know, even if we think that in some ways the program needed to be more uniform and tightened up a bit in some respects, I'm sure that it's the case that that there are some really needy people who are getting a much more skeptical hearing than they would have gotten, and are being left in a tough economy despite having some sort of pretty significant personal challenge.
I want to touch on those five states in a moment, because I want to just talk a little bit politically about this, because those particular five states are sort of interesting from a political standpoint in terms of this becoming a hot potato. And I would say that it seems to me that there's certain inevitability, right? When you have a program that is based on such subjective factors, I mean, the bottom line is you've got to make a... And it's not such a clear cut thing, because a bureaucracy of this size doesn't necessarily make a conscious choice. It's there's sort of a just a general feeling, but the choice is made at one point. Either we're going to take in people who arguably are not deserving to make sure that we don't keep out anybody who is deserving, or we're going to do the opposite, right? And it's either like, you know, how much sort of human misery are we willing to neglect to make sure that we don't let anybody in who sees getting, you know, $1,150 a month and Medicare as some type of, live in large experience.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And so that in some respects, you know, I think like that's as good of a measure of society as any, right? I mean, we're willing to have some people who maybe, live in large on that $1,100 a month, to make sure that we don't leave anybody who is in desperate straits. Now, is there a dynamic too? Let me ask you this, that is at play, where you've had particularly, you know, we have seen the limitations and I would argue the failure of welfare reform in a period where we have a lot less jobs. Is there a dynamic where you have on the ground people saying to a mom who, you know, is can't find work, is not eligible for TANF, for temporary needy assistance for families, saying, hey, you know, you seem to have a limp. Maybe you should try for this. I mean, is that dynamic going on? Are there social workers sort of shifting the responsibility from maybe the state finances to the federal finances?
You know, I'm sure that, I mean, it's a big country, and, you know, when you have a country of 300 million, that is, there's going to be some of that. And after welfare reform, parents who had kids with a disability always had the choice, do I enroll my child in SSI or do I enroll my child in traditional welfare? And in the low welfare benefit states, they were more likely to go with SSI. There's always some element of that. And to some extent, you know, the same was true if the parent had some kind of a health issue. When you look at, I don't think there's as much of that as people think that there is. One reason being that if you look at women's enrollment in SSDI, if it was sort of welfare reform closed off one spigot and opened up another, you would have seen a lot of women coming on in like 1997, 1998, and so on. And by then, the real increase in women's enrollment in this program had really pretty much stabilized. You know, there were still things happening because the population was aging and so on. But the real the part of the increase that was hard to explain was kind of over by the time that welfare reform really kicked in. So there's some of that, and states certainly try to do that. But, you know, because it's a pretty stringent program, it's not that easy to do. You know, if somebody says, hey, you know, it looks like you have a limp there, you know, you're not going to get too far within this. You know, there's a real process of documenting, you know, medical conditions. So I think that I'm sure that you can identify that this is happening, but I don't think it's explaining why the SSDI program, you know, overall has increased, or why we have a financial problem making it work. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think my argument for something like that is, you know, there's no big, whether it's private or public enterprise that doesn't have a certain percentage of fraud. But there's clearly, yeah, you know, when you have 50% of applicants being turned away around one, this is, you know, that's a pretty risky chance to take. Like, I'm gonna go through this process and rely on that. And again, you know, it's not like if you get through this process, it's going to be peaches and cream after this.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
It's going to be yachts and luxury. It's worth rolling the dice. No, it's you're like, congratulations, you're on subsistence living now.
By the way, if I could add two things to that. One thing is, ironically, if you were really interested in preventing fraud, the one thing you would definitely want to do is to adequately fund the bureaucracy,
right,
and the processes through which we actually can check people's claims and process claims in a timely way and so on. And Congress, you know, really does not like to fund the sort of blocking and tackling of making bureaucracy work well. And so some of the, you know, we could do a better job in detecting fraud and in speedily rejecting cases that don't deserve to be on the program. Because if someone shouldn't be on the program, you want to very speedily reach that decision so that they're not wasting their time in the application process. You know, you want them to know they have to go out and get a job before they accumulate a long period of poor work attachment while they're,
right,
sort of trying to look credible to disability. So, you know, Congress has been reluctant to spend the money on that. The second thing that you'd want to really do is make sure that you have a strong Medicaid program in place, because many of these people who should not be on the program still have a very real medical problem, and they're low income. And there are a lot of people for whom the answer should probably be, you know, you have a real health, let's make sure that we take care of your heart problem. And if you can't afford to get to a good you know, academic medical center that can take care of your heart failure, you know, we're going to make sure that you can do that. We don't think that you need to be on an income support system because we think you're capable of working, but we're going to help you with your health insurance. A lot of the states where, you know, you have these high SSDI take-up rates are states that are very ambivalent or have rejected the
Medicaid.
Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion.
Kentucky,
yeah.
That's what, I mean, that brings us back to these five states. It's West Virginia, yeah, Kentucky, Alabama, Arkansas, and Mississippi that have,
yeah,
more than 10% of the population age 18, yeah, to 64 now receiving some form of federal disability benefits. It would mm-hmm. be really fascinating to look at Kentucky, I guess, in particular, to see if getting medical treatment on a regular basis actually cuts down on the number of long-term disabilities that prevent people from being able to work.
But I think that's a very interesting question. And also whether it changes, whether the ALJs will just feel more comfortable saying to somebody, you know, now that I know that your health care is going to be taken care of, I feel more comfortable saying, you know, you're a marginal case.
Right.
Because I think very often at a human level, people are saying, you know, here's this person who has very important needs that need to be met. And how am I going to make sure this person gets health care and gets the supports that they need? And if SSDI is the only way to do that, I'm really going to look and make sure that, you know, is there any way I can get this person on the program? If there's other ways to do that, you know, that you may feel, well, I don't feel quite the same pressure to bend the rule on the SSDI eligibility to make sure that you get your health condition taken care of.
Now, this may not be directly in your portfolio, but does when you hear states like West Virginia, Kentucky, Alabama, mm-hmm. Arkansas, and Mississippi are the ones with these rates of over 10% on mm-hmm. on federal disability, does that impact the politics at all? I mean, is you know when I don't know that the nominee Trump, but maybe the nominee Cruz is up there with Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders and says, you know, the first thing we've got to do is get rid of all this fraud in Social Security disability insurance. If they respond, well, you know, it's true. West Virginia, Kentucky, Alabama, Arkansas, and Mississippi seem to have abnormally high rates. I mean, what? Yeah. How does that? Is that going to? Am I just sort of, you know, in a slight state of delusion, you know, thinking that that would have some impact in terms of the politics of this? Or is it just going to be one of those straight, there's a lot of fraud in SSDI and the Democratic candidates? Well, I'm sure there's some, and we should definitely deal with that, but it's a good program overall. Or, I mean, is this something you could take somebody into the deep end with?
That's a very good question. I mean, the problem is that, you know, you might think, well, if these are red states, then politicians who are popular in red states would have some accountability for that. These are the same states where the majorities in the state legislatures are turning down free federal money to take care of their own citizens. So they may, you know, the psychological distance that many of the conservative politicians seem to have regarding you know, the residents of the states that they represent who need public help is so great that it's a little hard for me to predict how the politics would go on this issue. And I one of the ironies of American life is that liberals are just begging, you know, the red states to take our money.
Right.
And, you know, in these social programs. And and they seem to be very resistant to taking the money. And I mean, if by the logic, you know, Mississippi would be the state that you would think of, Alabama, Mississippi, you would think would be absolutely pining to take the Medicaid expansion because their own citizens are in such desperate need of health coverage. Clearly, that's not the way the politics in the states are operating at the moment.
But so, those are the poor citizens, right? I mean, does Social Security disability insurance, does it have a different, slightly different profile because it at least presumably it's not a function of income eligibility or no?
Well, I mean, to be blunt about it, of course, it's a whiter population in these states than the Medicaid expansion population.
That's
overall.
What I'm saying. Yeah. I mean,
not to put, it may be different. And it's certainly, I think, by the way, that one place where it really is different is I really don't take seriously threats to, you know, there's going to be something that's going to like shut down the government if we don't really cut SSDI benefits or something like that. I think politicians are, they will not do, from any party, I think, will not do anything that would drastically harm the SSDI population because they remember early in the Reagan administration, President Reagan imposed some very punitive measures on federal disability programs, and it was one of the worst political disasters in the in recent memory. And he was just savaged in the press for it. There were suicides. There were all sorts of bureaucratic mistakes made where people in mental hospitals got letters explaining that they had been cut off of their disability benefits because they were no longer ill, you know, things like that. And there's just no way that anybody's going to go down that road again, because one thing about disability policy is that all of the people that are on the program are very identifiable people who right. have real health problems and who have human faces, and a reporter can just go out and talk to them and hear their story. And so I think there's going to be all sorts of drama, over the next year about how to fix SSDI, but I would be very surprised if anything really punitive were done because of the tremendous political risk, particularly in a presidential election year, of going down that road.
I think you might underestimate Ted Cruz, but be that as it may, I hope that you are right. Harold Pollack, thank you so much for your time today. I can't tell you, regular listeners of this program know how excited I was when I read your piece and thought I'd have you on the program. Because SSDI, it's just my own little quirk, but I get very excited about this type of stuff. So I really appreciate you coming on.
You're doing a real public service, and I enjoyed speaking with you.
All right. Well, thank you again.
Thanks a lot.
Now, it's the end of the summer, ladies and gentlemen. Like I said earlier in the show, I could not let the summer pass without talking to David Dayen again. So I interviewed David 2 days ago about three different stories. One about what the Fed is supposedly planning to do. And I actually mentioned the words Lawrence Kudlow or Larry Kudlow in that interview. So you're going to want to tune in for that. Stick around for that alone. But also some more stories about how the failure to prosecute any of these scammers, fraudsters, banksters in this whole mortgage crisis continues to implicate the behavior of these people today. So stick around. David Dayen, we will definitely be back on Monday. At the very least, members will have a deep archive show tomorrow, Friday. And have a great Labor Day weekend, folks. Here's that interview with David Dayen. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program once again, ladies and gentlemen, contributing writer for Salon, for The Intercept, for, the Pacific Standard, right?
That's been a while.
Okay. Well, it's impossible to keep up with your career and soon to... be a book author. David Dayen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Now, I wanted to, as summer is ending officially as of next week on Labor Day, I wanted to get you on one more time during the course of the summer. And really, there's been like three pieces that you've written as of late that I wanted to talk about. Let's start with the one on the Fed, because this is a... it's fascinating to see where people fall on this. I was listening to Larry Kudlow, if you can believe it, over the weekend, or maybe it was a week or two ago. And he was complaining about this notion that he's reading commenters talking about how the Fed needs to man up. And I think that you and Kudlow are going to be on in a similar position, maybe for slightly different reasons. But what is the Fed contemplating doing? Or we never know what they're going to do. We just get ideas of what they're about to do.
Right. So September, there is a policy meeting of the Fed. And as we know, the interest rate, the main federal funds rate, the rate that the Fed helps set, has been zero or near zero since December 2008. So recently...
And just tell us, for those who don't know, what does that mean, I mean, in terms of our daily lives?
Right. So that is the, I mean, officially, that's the rate at which banks lend to one another. And so banks can lend to one another at very low rates, and if they can do that, then they will presumably offer loans to the public also at fairly low rates. So the idea of lowering interest rates is to make conditions for investment, for borrowing, very attractive, and then hopefully by association, raise economic activity.
So
that's the whole idea.
So it would mean that my mortgage rates are lower, so I have the opportunity to spend more on a house and basically buy a house for more money than I otherwise would have. So someone's going to make that money, or I can go and expand my business and attempt to create more a business for myself by, you know, I'll offer on the Majority Report. Now I'll offer, you know, koozies or whatever.
So, koozies aside, yes. the idea is to increase economic activity. Obviously, since December 2008, we've been in this. We've had the recession. We've had the financial crisis. And the idea was to make easy money policies, this is sometimes called, to make it easy to acquire money at a very low rate. And that would hopefully spur economic demand in some way. And so this has been going on for years and years. And basically, the Fed balances that, the idea of trying to maximize employment with trying to ensure low inflation, that inflation doesn't get out of control, as it were. And so those two things, which sometimes are in tension, are reflected in that interest rate. Because what the Fed does is that if they see interest rates rising, they will, or if they see inflation rising, they will raise interest rates to, as it were, cool down the economy.
And theoretically, when we see these inflation rates rise, what that means is that there's simply more demand for products than the economy has the ability to produce. So that would indicate that there's
that's when prices rise, is when supply, you know, exceeds demand. And incidentally, we're not seeing that and haven't seen that for years and years and years. Nevertheless, there has been tons of chatter that the Fed wants to, quote-unquote, lift off and raise interest rates to return us to, and this is another direct quote, return to normalcy. Because we've been in this zero interest rate environment for a long time, and I guess the Fed's bored with it or something. they don't want to continue in this fashion. And they want to return to a normal rate environment, which would be, you know, if you look at the average over the last decade or two, actually you can't look at this decade because it's been zero most of the time, but previous decades, maybe 2%, maybe 3%.
Now, who benefits from that? I mean, so we should say at this point that there's you know, from what I've read, the stock market has been going up because, in large part, because there's, you know, people can borrow this money, and I guess institutions could theoretically. It just creates a certain amount of liquidity for wealthy people, and it raises the value of stocks. And so
that's the investor side, but of course banks are pretty cool with raising interest rates because it enables them to raise longer term interest rates like mortgages and things like that and make more money. So banks aren't necessarily opposed to increasing interest rates. So there are sort of competing, you have investors on the one side and you have banks on the other.
And the rest of us are, how does it impact the vast majority rest of us who don't have big stock portfolios and don't own
exactly. Well, we're not normally seen as part of the equation. That is indeed the problem, and it's a problem that, that some members of the public are trying to solve. There is this coalition called Fed Up. I don't know if you've had them on the program. But they are a group that's trying to encourage the Fed to keep rates low and showing the human cost, as you say. Because really, when you're talking about raising interest rates, you're saying, the Fed is saying, that the economy is becoming too healthy too quickly. I don't know anyone that would agree with that statement that actually is in the real economy. Wages have been stagnant for something like 35 years in America. We have better unemployment rates for some people, but you know, unemployment rates in the black community are twice as much as the standard unemployment rate overall. So
we also have not as many people participating in the workforce. Now, part of that is, I think,
and there's that
demographics.
And there's that.
But part of it is also that people just got exhausted from looking for work, essentially.
Yeah. And the biggest problem is that this rate increase, this craze to make a rate increase, seems like a solution in search of a problem. As I mentioned, the Fed has sort of a target inflation rate they want to hit every month, and they have missed that target inflation rate for 37 straight months. And they've missed it all the time lower, and in fact, it's getting more of a miss as the months go on.
All right, be more explicit. Be more explicit as to what that target rate is and what it means.
The target rate is 2%. And so if inflation is running at 2%, the Fed sees them as doing their job. They have not done their job the last 37 months, and the target rate has always, or the actual rate has always been below 2%. In fact, now we're close to zero and nearing a deflation point because oil prices have gone very, very low, and that affects the price of all goods because it involves shipping costs. So there is no urgency to increase rates other than this idea from, you know, very serious, sober-minded people at the Fed that that's just what they should do. There's also this crazy notion that we have to raise rates now because if we get a recession, we won't be able to lower rates to help boost the economy after a recession. So it's like we have to raise them now so that we can lower and hurt the economy so that when the economy gets hurt, we can lower them. I mean, that's literally the argument. So it's very puzzling what's going on at the central bank. And certainly the views of ordinary folks are not being considered. That's something that the Fed Up Coalition tried when they stormed this conference that Fed officials were holding in Jackson Hole, Wyoming last week. And they came there with the message that, look, what you're doing has serious effects on ordinary people. And you need to look at the data before you make this decision, rather than just making it because you think it's something you should do.
Weren't people, I guess, optimistic about Janet Yellen when she came in, that she was very conscious of the Fed's role in trying to prioritize jobs over inflation? And does she not have is it simply a question of, you know, this, she cannot make a unilateral decision? Is she changed? I mean, it's
right.
So
well,
hard,
indeed,
I think.
Indeed, people were praiseworthy of Yellen. And if you remember, the competition was between, are we going to take Janet Yellen or Larry Summers?
Right.
And Larry Summers was seen as the guy who would listen to the grand poobahs and and raise rates preemptively, things of that nature. Indeed, now we're seeing Summers from the outside say that now is not the time to raise rates prematurely, whereas Yellen, in that position, is doing the opposite. And I think actually what that tells you is that there are these tremendous pressures inside that position. That if Larry Summers was there, I wouldn't suspect there would be a whole lot different going on than what is going on right now. But if he's from the outside and has absolutely no means to implement any of his ideas, he can be free to say, well, what I think we should do is a very liberal thing. So that's, I think, what's going on.
Are those pressures basically just like basic other bankers who just end up shaping the world?
It's Congress. It's other investors. It's international central bankers. And by the way, when the Fed tightens and raises rates, it probably makes the dollar stronger and helps countries abroad in terms of the relative value of their exports. And so you have all these international central bankers saying, just get on with it, just raise rates already. Meanwhile, we've seen time and again since the recession, countries that raise their interest rates prematurely, places like Sweden, Japan, have all suffered a tremendous cost for that in terms of their economies slowing down. And we're kind of going headlong into that, even though there is nothing in the data that shows that now is the time that we really, really have to raise rates. Now, I should say that the rates that are going to go up are going to go up a pretty minuscule amount. You're talking about 0.25%. They want to start this process of lifting off, but not do it all at once, necessarily. However, if there's no reason to do it at all, I don't see why it's a mitigating factor that you're just going to raise rates a little bit.
It's just, I think it's so weird, hard for people to understand where, yeah, you know, things like the imposition of austerity in general, like why would the idea that these are customs, or that even you could refer to this and explain this as sort of manning up, is just such a weird dynamic. And of course, it ends up hurting normal people who don't own banks, which is not to say that people are abnormal if they own a bank, I guess, but maybe they are. I don't know. All right. Well, be that as it may, let's move on to some of the other stories you've been writing about. But in fact, both of which lead me to believe that perhaps people who own banks are not so normal. Let's start with the one where you have you've been writing about some emails, which show which are basically solicitations to fraudulently claim ownership of loans. I guess. I mean, describe
it. This is quite incredible. So there's a guy named Bill Patalo, and he's a private investigator. He's been working in this process of helping defense attorneys who have issues with mortgages. Of course, we had this long situation that began actually 5 years ago where the nation's largest mortgage servicers stopped their foreclosure operations because it was proven that they were fabricating documents. And, you know, we remember this as the robo-signing scandal. People were signing these mortgage assignments and signing these affidavits without having any of the underlying information, even though the affidavit says, I attest to the underlying information as being correct, and they were admitting in depositions that it wasn't correct or that they had no idea. They were, you know, fabricating mortgage assignments because they did not control ownership over the actual mortgage. This is probably beyond our scope here, but there was basically in securitization, the slicing and dicing of loans that happened during the housing bubble, basically the proper procedures were not followed, and those securitizations were invalid, essentially.
So, in other words, let me just wrap it up quickly for people. When you transfer basically ownership of a note, of a loan, to someone else, there is a because we're talking about property here, there's a paper trail. And in this instance, because they were slicing and dicing this stuff up so much and wanted to try and monetize as much as they could of this and securitize it, nobody followed any of the procedures. So there was a lot of room for people not to know whether or not a certain entity actually owned that note. And
Correct.
You can't obviously say, like, I'm going to foreclose on your property because you haven't paid off your loan if you can't establish that you're actually the owner of that loan. And in many instances, I mean, aside from this is not just a matter about paperwork, right? I mean, in many instances, these people, there was no way to know if they really owned the loan.
Right. I mean, it's the same thing as if you took someone to court for stealing your car. At some point, you would have to have the documentation that that car actually belongs to you. The problem was these mortgage companies did not have the documentation that the loan and the note belonged to them. And so when they would go in to try to foreclose on somebody, the defense attorney would say, well, where is your proof that you are the actual owner of this loan and have the right to enforce the lien and acquire this property? And they said, well, here it is. I just wrote it, scribbled it on a pad right here, and here you go.
David, let me just stop you. Okay, let me just answer a critic here.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if I've taken a loan out to pay for my house, I've taken out a loan. There is somebody, theoretically, right, who I owe that money to. Do we have a sense of, like, how that matched up? I mean, in other words, like, people say, well, what harm does it do? They said they fabricated the documents. I mean, it's not like this house didn't have a loan and somebody's got to, it's got to be paid to somebody.
Right. That neglects the fact that a lot of these defaults and were servicer driven. In other words, the mortgage servicer told the borrower to miss payments because that's the only way that they could get a loan modification. They were struggling. And when they missed the payments, then they put them into default. There are reams of documentary evidence that servicers used their power to force people into default. And we also have plenty of instances where people were getting foreclosed on without ever missing a payment. People were getting foreclosed on without ever having a loan. Two different entities were foreclosing on the same house, each claiming to own a copy of the note. There was absolute chaos and remains absolute chaos in this industry. And to say that, well, someone really did this person missed some payments, and, you know, even if they don't have the right documentation, we should still allow this to go through, is kind of like saying, well, you know, sure, I planted the murder weapon on the suspect, but that doesn't mean he didn't do it. I mean,
right.
You know, that we should still allow that to go forward. So that's my problem with it, and certainly and there's also a thing called the rule of law and property rights.
No, I remember that
kind
from
of what
the 90s.
Makes us, yeah. Property rights are kind of what makes us a capitalist society. It's the bulwark of capitalism. If you can't have confidence that the property that you own is clear of any errors or defects, then you wouldn't have any confidence to sell it. Everything
right.
basically breaks down if you don't have this confidence, and we shouldn't have this confidence. And wait till you hear what I'm about to tell you. So this guy, Bill Patello, he's been working in this industry as a private investigator, working with defense attorneys, and helping in these mortgage cases where these people can't prove that they own the note. So he gets an email, unsolicited, gets it out of the blue, from a company called Security Connections. Security Connections We know from this time 6-7 years ago in the crisis, was a company that's, they're basically a doc shop. They create mortgage documents for their clients when they are missing. And so this woman at Security Connections writes Bill Pazzolo and says, hey, I have a client and they need a mortgage assignment that's missing, and it needs to go from Washington Mutual to Residential Credit Solutions, which is a mortgage servicing company. And she says, do you think you can make that assignment? Now, what she's saying there is, do you think you can fabricate a document for a loan, which, by the way, was taken out in 2002, so she wants him to backdate a 13-year-old transaction and create a document that says that this company sold it to this other company 13 years ago, and now they can release the mortgage. So the guy who is absolutely flabbergasted that anyone would come to him who's been working on the other side this whole time and ask him to forge a mortgage document decides to play it kind of coy and says, well, exactly what are you looking for? And the reply is that, you know, they do releases, the Security Connections, this doc shop does releases of mortgage for Residential Credit Solutions, and basically what that means is it seems to me that the reason you get a release of mortgage if you're Residential Credit Solutions, which specializes in delinquent loans, is so they can do something called a deed in lieu foreclosure, and what that means is that they take the property and forgive the debt on the homeowner, and then they can resell the property. However, they can't resell the property if they don't have the full documentation to show the chain of title, as it were. Otherwise, someone else can go ahead and make a claim on that property if they try to sell it. So they are asking Security Connections to manufacture this documentation so that when they take this house, steal this house, as I see it, then they can pass it off to somebody else. So then this woman at Security Connections gives Bill a fill-in-the-blank mortgage assignment already pre-signed, pre-notarized. All he has to do is fill in the blank and sign his name to it, and that's what they're asking him to do. If I didn't know what I know about the mortgage industry, I would not believe that this happened.
So is she, let's just be clear,
absolutely remarkable.
So is that woman from the CSR or whatever, to security? Is she just basically must have gotten this guy's name on a list of private eyes involved in mortgages and just
right.
Cold call
them
just to see, are you the type of guy who's willing to basically sign off on a fraudulent document for X number of dollars?
Right. If you're cynical about it, they were trying to entrap him and get him to sign a fraudulent document so that his business of helping people fight fraudulent documents would be ruined. If you're not cynical, then this is just some yokel, a team lead, which is a pretty low-level position at these companies, who just, was Googling Washington Mutual and saw this guy somehow associated to it, and they know they have to use third parties now for additional plausible deniability. Oh, we didn't know that third party must have...
Right, he was in charge of all the legal stuff.
He was in charge of that. I don't know. That's not my deal.
Option one is really dark.
So she just saw this person and associated his name to Washington Mutual and said, hey, maybe he'll do it. So will you forge this document is what she asked him to do. And it's...
So what's the status of it now? Did you contact that outfit, or what happened after that? Or
the status is that he broke off communications, and he brought it to me and said this is what's going on.
Did you call her?
What's incredible is that this comes you know, not just 5 years after mortgage companies suspended their operations, but 3 years, over 3 years, after a settlement was done by the federal government and every state attorney general, with the exception of Oklahoma, and mortgage companies who promised not to do this again. And the truth is that this never stopped. You would presume when you do a settlement with a group of companies over an illegal behavior that that behavior might stop or at least slow down, let's say. But it did not. And basically they were given a slap on the wrist and business as usual commenced.
Well,
that.
To be fair, at least they were trying to outsource the actual you know,
these are the only real change is that they separated the relationship a little bit more.
Right. And they're expanding they're expanding the economic activity around it, right? Because
True. They are bringing in new entrepreneurs, people looking for a chance, looking for a break, who might want to have a career in document forgery.
Let's just take 5 quick minutes to talk about the other end of that story, too, where a guy misses 2 payments on a house. Was it on the Jersey Shore?
It was actually in Morris Township, New Jersey, which is northern Jersey.
Tell this story, because I'm curious as to how widespread you think this is, because we hear these stories here and there, and I wonder if it's we don't hear more of it simply because these are sort of like very localized stories in some way, and it doesn't occur to the victims of these stories to say, like, hey, I wonder if there's a guy out there who would write about this in a national,
I'll tell you, every time I write a story like this, I get people coming out of the woodwork telling me this happened to them or this happened to a friend of theirs or this happened to someone they know. What happened is this guy named David Adier, his father lived in Morris Township, New Jersey. This was the family home. They had it in their family for 40 years. The father finally succumbed to Parkinson's disease after a very long illness, and he died in August of 2012. There were some mispayments on the home. A lot of them seemed to have to do with the fact that he was, the father was the only person on the deed, and there was a lot of trouble in David and his sister trying to prove to Wells Fargo, who was the mortgage servicer, that they actually had an interest in the property as the executor of the estate. So there were problems with that. There were these 2 mispayments. Now, what happens typically in these cases is Wells Fargo hires a contractor to do what is called property preservation. And those contractors go out to the property, they see whether or not it's abandoned, and if they believe it is abandoned, they can, and this is in the mortgage, they can enter the property if it's abandoned to protect their investment. Because if they're going to get it in a foreclosure, many cities and states make them liable for any kind of damages or hazards on the property. And so they can go in, winterize the home, shut down any water or gas and do these kinds of things to protect their investment. The problem is that the contractors have huge financial incentives to say that the home is abandoned, whether or not it is. And that's because they get paid maybe $2 or $5 to inspect the home and hundreds of dollars to do the winterizing and the maintenance and the changing the locks and all of those things that are done in a property preservation scenario. So we have dozens, if not hundreds, of cases where these contractors break into homes that are not abandoned, sometimes not in foreclosure at all, and change the locks and do all these things. And in many cases, they do what is called a trash out, which is they take the belongings that are in the home and dump them and throw them away and take them away.
Theoretically,
in this case,
right?
Or steal them. Right. In this case, what some of the belongings that were taken from the home were things that the father, Henry Adier, took with him from France in 1940 after fleeing the Nazis. And in a true irony, he had to break into his own apartment to get these goods when the Nazis sealed up all of these homes presumed to be inhabited by Jews in 1940. They actually broke in, broke the seal, and took what they could. It was a Kiddush cup, a Seder plate, a sewing machine that was used by David Adier's grandmother. So these are family heirlooms that were in the family for decades. And a contractor working for Wells Fargo just up and took them out of the house and grabbed them. This is not unique. I've heard cases where family pets have been taken. I've heard cases where people are sitting in the home when it's being broken into, and they call 911, and it's the bank who is breaking into their home instead of a burglar or intruder. It is absolute violation. It's completely shocking. The industry of property preservation is completely broken. There are financial incentives for them to not care whether or not the home is abandoned, as long as they make their money on the back end doing all of this property preservation activity. And it continues. It continues. According to lawyers I've talked to, it continues unabated. There's no difference in frequency between now and the height of the foreclosure crisis 5-6 years ago.
Well, just stunning. And, you know, it's, well, that's your summer dose of David Day and cheer.
Take it once a season, I think, is probably the smallest dose that you would want.
Folks, you can go to daviddayan.tumblr.com to keep up with what David Dayan is writing, because he literally writes everywhere, and it seems like constantly, and with a depth and a breadth of few writers I have ever come across. David, always a pleasure. Have a great Labor Day weekend.
Thanks a lot.
All right, folks. Say to Napoli.